بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه ومن والاه. Welcome everyone back for a new discussion, a new book. This will be short classes going over المختصر الصغير, the short summary or short abridgment in the Shafi'i Madhab by the well-known scholar Abdullah ibn Abd al-Rahman Bafadl al-Hadrami. So again, this is another introductory level book in Shafi'i Fiqh that is written by one of the great scholars of Hadramaut in Yemen. And as I've mentioned in other venues and other places, these texts that we're teaching on this forum, the Shafi'i Fiqh texts, rather, I mean specifically, are meant to be introductory level things. So this is just a sip of water of the ocean of fiqh. And the purpose of these classes and the purpose of these books is to give somebody that initial start that they need to re-engage with the basic practices of Islam. So this book, for example, will only talk about acts of worship. And at the very end, he has a very short chapter on business transactions, talking about the basic structure of how we buy and sell things. And that's it. But of course, Islamic law covers many, many, many things. And just to put that in perspective, if you look at the sentences of Islamic law, what do I mean by the sentences of Islamic law? Islamic law judges acts. What is the ruling of this act? What is the ruling of that act? The answer is going to be one of five things. It's either wajib, or it's haram, or it's makruh, mubah, or mandub, the five rulings of the Sharia. How many of those sentences do, if we amass all of the books of Islamic law across all of the madhahib, how many sentences of Islamic law do we have? We have about 1.2 million of those sentences. So just to give you a sense of why I call this just a sip of water, this is just basic understanding. Consider, you know, think of these classes as Islam 101, just to kind of help you start. Of course, when you start talking about fiqh, it elicits many questions that people have. So hopefully we'll have time for those type of questions, just in case, you know, in case people want to ask. Okay, so without further ado, let us begin. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Qala al-Musannifu rahimahullah wa nafa'na bi'alumihi fi ad-darain amin. The author says, may Allah Ta'ala be pleased with him and may we benefit from his knowledge in this world and in the next. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, the most merciful, the most gracious. All praise is to Allah, the world of the Lord, the Lord of both worlds. I testify that there is no God but Allah without any partner. And I testify that Muhammad is the slave and messenger. May peace and blessings be upon him, his companions, and all the believers. Just give me a second, because that translation in my mind strikes me as slightly problematic, that he would not begin in that fashion. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Okay, not the two, not both worlds, but worlds plural. So I just wanted to look at the original Arabic there. Worlds plural. Al-Alameen. Not Al-Alamein. Al-Alameen. Because there are many awalim, there are many worlds. And that's something that's important that we remember, that there is this world, the perceivable, well, there's this world as in earth, mother earth, etc. But there's also this world as the dunya, you know, as what we see from the, I like to translate it as the observable universe. Anything that we can see with the eye, i.e. the aided eye as well, the telescope and satellite and, you know, things are sent out from earth and they give us snapshots, all of that is one world. There are other levels. There are other worlds. Seba samawat. We believe in the seven heavens, and we see seba aradin, and we believe in the seven earths. And I mentioned before that this scheme of the Islamic, what we call Islamic cosmology, the belief of the heavens and the earth, is basically what informed somebody like Dante when he wrote his famous poem, The Divine Comedy. The stratification of the levels of hell and punishments that increase, and then the levels of heaven and the rewards that increase, etc., comes from our cosmology, largely. Not only, but largely. So, Rabbul Alameen means the Lord of all of these awalim. And then there are the other awalim, the other heavens that we don't see. And that's part of our belief, is that we believe in what we see, and we also believe in what we don't see. Anyway, returning to the text, may Allah, may peace and blessings be upon Sayyidina Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, his companions, his family, and all the believers. This is a summary of what every Muslim should know in regards to obligatory actions, like purification, the things that we have to do before we pray, prayer, almsgiving, which is the zakah, fasting, and pilgrimage. These topics have been written as actions that are required by men, women, children, elderly, free men, and slaves. In other words, these are the basic things that Muslims have to do, irrespective of gender. So these are universal acts that constitute the obligations for a Muslim. In other terminology, we just simply refer to them as the five pillars. As with the other book, in this book, we are going to begin with purification, tahara. And I mentioned before that usually we begin with tahara. Books of fiqh begin with tahara because it's the prerequisite. And in our science of jurisprudence, in our science of usul al-fiqh, we have a principle, ما لا يتم الواجب إلا به فهو واجب. The things that are obligatory, that require things to be completed, then those prerequisites are also obligatory. So based on that, which is a general Sharia rule, that's why we usually begin the books in this fashion. There are six obligatory steps that make up pre-prayer washing or the wudu. Number one is the intention, which is made while washing one's face. The intention is in the heart, mahallu niyya al-qalb. So the intention is not something that you have to say. Usually when we teach children how to make wudu, usually we coach them by, you know, you can say as you start making wudu, nawaitu al-wudu, because what is said by the tongue helps inform by the heart. But that which is stated doesn't, that's not the niyyah. That's expressing something that's already in the heart. When he says it's made by while washing one's face, that's the point where it is obligated to have the niyyah. If you start washing your face, like let's say I'm really hot, I come out from outside, it's a summer day, and I come inside and I want to cool my face, and I start wetting my face, and then after that I'm like, you know what, maybe let me just continue and make wudu. That doesn't count because I did not start washing my face with that niyya. Now, when we know that from the sunnahs of wudu is that we start by washing our hands, and then we rinse our mouth and our nose, and then we wipe the face. So when he says the niyyah, which is made while washing one's face, that's when it becomes obligatory, because after that you've missed, the face is one of the integrals of wudu. Number two is washing the face, which includes hair and skin on the face, except skin beneath a heavy beard. The face in the Sharia is defined as where the hair usually starts on the top of the head, even if somebody is blind or has a, you know, receding hairline, to right below the chin, and from the beginning of one ear to the beginning of another ear. So all of that is considered the face. So all of that must be washed, including the skin on the face, except the skin beneath a heavy beard. What is the difference between a heavy beard for a man and a light beard? A light beard is that if you looked at the man's beard, you would be able to see the skin underneath. If that's the case, then the skin underneath the beard must be washed. But if you have a heavy beard, like maybe you would think of mine as beginning to be heavy, such that when you see this, you don't see the skin underneath, because you can see my skin here, but you can't see my skin here. So if you can't see the skin from the naked eye, then it is enough just to wipe over the beard, especially people that, you know, men that have like the big beards like that, they just go like that and that's enough. They don't have to, the water does not have to penetrate below it. Why did I say a man? Because if a woman has facial hair, this, it is not considered the default of a woman in the Sharia, so therefore the skin must be underneath, must be washed. Number three is washing the hands up until the elbows, which must include the elbows. The definition of the hands is beginning with the fingertips and including underneath the fingernails, in between the fingers and the thumb, the wrist, all the way to right above the elbow. Why do you go above the elbow? In order to make sure that you have covered the elbow. So in the face, when we said that the face starts where the hair starts, that means you will get, you will go a little bit beyond that, and you will actually wipe some of your head in order to make sure that you have gotten this part. And in the structure of our fiqh, this is called muqaddimatul wujub, the beginning things that are obligated, in order to make sure that you have gotten the obligated part. So when he says, which includes the elbow, which means that you will actually wipe part of your forearm because you will go beyond the elbow to make sure that you have washed the elbow. Number four, wiping some of the head. A strand of hair or skin on the top of the head will suffice. In the Shafi'i Madhab, the minimal amount of the head that needs to be wiped is just three hairs. So if you wet your fingers under the faucet and you just went like this, then that would suffice for the head. And of course, the other madhahib will say, you know, half the head or the whole head. But this is just explaining to you the bare minimums. And this might be helpful for sisters that are wearing hijab, that are in public and things like that. And then number five is washing the feet up to the ankles, which must include the ankles. The feet is defined as beginning with the toes, including underneath the toenails, in between the toes, the entire foot, and going slightly above the ankle. Again, in order to make sure that the ankle itself is washed. And then number six, all of this must be done in the exact order. So face, arms, head, or hands, head, feet. And then when it comes to the arms and to the feet, the hands and the feet, doing the right before the left. Okay. Pre-prayer washing, recommend, what are the sunnahs of before the wudu? Number one is using the miswak, the tooth stick, prior to starting the wash. So in the Shafi'i Madhab, the sunnah of the siwak is, you know, to do the siwak before you're going to engage in the process of wudu. Number two, start washing by saying Allah's name, Bismillah. So the sunnah is to say Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim or Bismillah. Number three, washing the hands to the wrist. As I mentioned, that's a sunnah, is to wash the hands first. Washing the mouth, madmada, swish and spit. And then washing the nose, istinshaq, by placing water in the palm of the hands and gently inhaling it. So usually it's done with one motion, that you fill your palm with some water, and then you put some in your mouth, some in your nose, blow out your mouth and spit out. And it just takes some practice. I like how he says gently inhaling, because if you do that with the water, you're going to damage yourself and it will be very unpleasant. So it's just a slight inhaling that because mashallah, we pray five times a day and at least, and we make at least, you know, five, seven wudu's a day. So very quickly, the practice kind of kicks in. Number six, removal of water from the washed part of the hands. So if after we've washed the hands, to sort of just push the water out, take the water out, doing every action three times, wiping the whole head instead of part of it, wiping the inner and the outer ear. The outer ear is the ear that you can see. The inner ear is, if I go like this with my ear, what we would say in a common, behind the ear. That's considered I made a mistake. The outer ear is what you can see, including behind the ear. The inner ear is the finger slightly is inside the ear, and it's being wiped. For a thick beard, to run your wet hands through it, tahleel, so instead of just wiping it, to put your fingers through the hair to get it wet underneath, that would be a sunnah. Washing between the fingers, tahleel, only if It's an addition. But if the only way the water can get in between your fingers and toes is to go like this, then you have to do that. And then going beyond the washing area of washing, as I mentioned, is a sunnah only if the normal way guarantees that you have washed the body part. But if you are doubtful, then you must go above the normal way in order to make sure that you've washed what is obligated to wash. Number 13, doing each action consecutively without stopping. What is the definition of the consecutive without stopping and mu'ala? Is that one body part has not dried before you've gone to the next body part. As long as the previous body part is still wet, that means it is considered mu'ala, consecutive. Number 14, not using assistance when washing for prayer. That is asking someone to pour the water for you, so to do it yourself. Or in this, in our case, we just use the faucet in the bathroom. And number 15, do not dry off water. Air dry naturally is preferable. Now, only when it's not going to create a problem. But if you live in a cold environment and you have and you're wearing socks and shoes, you have to dry, because if you put your wet foot in the shoe and in the sock, then you're going to create mold and a bad smell and a bad odor. So when he says that, that is in an open environment where you're wearing sandals and it's dry, you know, and you know, within moments you'll be dry. But if you're going to be wet and then track that wetness into the mosque and on the carpet of the mosque, but you're creating a health hazard. So you've gone the opposite. You've gone against the sunnah. So that needs to be understood in its, you know, obviously in its context. Okay. The nawakhid of wudu, what causes us to lose our wudu? There are four actions that break the wudu. Number one, anything that may be excreted from the penis, vagina, and or anus, that is stool, urine, blood, etc. I think that is self-explanatory. Lack of mental alertness, that is sleeping, except when falling asleep in a sitting position or insanity. So if you sleep and your butt is firmly against the floor or the seat, like the way I'm sitting now, and I fall asleep like this, even if I start snoring and I'm sleeping like this for an hour, I don't lose my wudu. But if I just would, like, were leaning against the wall and I fell asleep just for a moment, at that moment that I fell asleep, I would lose my wudu. As for insanity, insanity requires, when you, if it's temporary insanity, a person comes back, it requires ghusl. That's why he wrote it in that way. I think we're going to get to ghusl very shortly. And then touching the skin of the opposite sex that may be marriageable. So in the Shafi'i madhab, if you touch a member of the opposite sex, even if it's by accident, even without any feeling or emotion, that would cause you to lose your wudu, with the exception of touching a person's teeth or hair, which is not considered part of the body in the Shafi'i madhab. It's an exception to that rule. Number four, touching the penis, vagina, and or anus with the palm of the hand or with the fingertips, touching oneself or the privates of another person. Meaning that if you went like this and you closed your hands, anything that's touching itself, whatever's touching the other part, that, if you touch the privates with that. But if you touch the privates with this, the outside, that does not lose your wudu. So, you know, parents that are helping children changing diapers or in the washroom or something like that, that would be an important distinction to keep in mind. Okay, if the wudu is broken or nullified, the following cannot be performed. So what can't you do if you don't have wudu? You can't pray, because there's no prayer without wudu. You can't make tawaf around the Kaaba, because there's no tawaf without wudu. You can't touch the Qur'an. What is the definition of the Qur'an? The definition of the Qur'an is all of the surahs from Al-Fatiha to An-Nas written in the Uthmanic script in one volume. This is the technical definition of the Qur'an. So my phone and the Qur'an app on my phone is not the Qur'an. If I have like Ayatul Kursi on a necklace, that's not considered the Qur'an. If I had the people that publish the Quran, but in juz, either like all each juz is in a single volume. Let's say there are 30 parts, and I take like one of those parts and I'm holding it. That one part is not considered the Quran because it's not the entirety of it. And it has to be written in the Othmanic script, which is the standard script of the Quran. So the majority opinion in the family of Sunni fiqh is that we cannot touch the Quran without wudu. There are some dispensations in other schools for those that are learning and so on and so forth. Touching the Quran, and number four is also carrying the Quran. So, you know, that would even include like having it in a bag or something like that, or like moving it from place to place. And then number five, directly touching an item that contains any Islamic knowledge, except if an item is in one's luggage. I've never heard of that. Let me check the original Arabic. ومس المصحف وحمله واللوح المكتوب للدراسة ويجوز حمله في أمتعة دراهم ومن انتقد ودوءه حرم عليه الصلاة وطواف ومس المصحف وحمله واللوح المكتوب. Oh, لا, that's a wrong translation. The لوح, I have one here. If you excuse me, I'll grab it for you to show you what that means. This is a lawh, a traditional way of studying. So you would sit down with the sheikh and you would, you know, you would write your lesson, right? And then you would sit and you like memorize it. And then you would go to the back and write the next lesson. And so you can go back and forth. So this lawh, it would be, what he's saying is that if the lawh has the Quran on it, then it wouldn't be permissible to touch if you don't have wudu. But that's kind of the opposite of what I just said. So that's something where I'm not sure why it's written like that in the original Arabic. I want to just go back one more second. But it is permissible to have it if it's in your luggage and for a young person to be able to carry it. I think that's more out of adab. That is not a proper fiqh ruling in the Shafi'i madhab. Wallahu alam. However, a child learning Islamic knowledge is allowed to carry without proper purification. Okay. Etiquette of using the restroom. You enter with the left foot and exit with the right foot. This is the sunnah. Do not carry anything with Allah's name in it, or the messenger's name, or the Quran, unless you have nowhere else to put it and you fear that it would get lost or damaged elsewhere. So if I had a bag that had a Quran in it and I was in a public space, I mean, and I need to use the bathroom, where else am I going to put the Mus'haf? The Mus'haf might get lost or stepped on if I leave it outside. In that case, that would be an exception. Again, these are etiquettes. That's a fiqhi ruling, but the rest of the list is an etiquette. Covering the head, that's considered an etiquette if the bathroom is filthy. But in our modern day bathrooms, the modern day bathrooms are very clean compared to when these type of books were written. So that would not necessarily apply. Number four, go somewhere private while using the restroom. In Arabic, the restroom is called al-khala. Al-khala means far away. So this is in the case where there is no dedicated place for the bathroom. Number five, do not urinate in still water or in a small quantity of running water, because the still water, it's not moving, so then the urine will not be moved and it will sully the water. Do not urinate in an unknown hole in the ground out in the wilderness, because if you find out in the wilderness a hole in the ground, most likely a creature lives there and that would be harming the creature. Number seven, do not urinate in the direction of the wind when outside, and obviously because then the urine is going to come back on you. Number eight, do not relieve yourself in a man-made shade. Example, a bus station or a subway. Any shaded area, because The shaded areas are where people go to rest and to seek refuge, and animals too. Do not receive yourself in the road or public property. Do not relieve yourself in a ventilation system. I mean, that's self-explanatory. Do not relieve yourself under a fertile tree, because the tree takes up from the soil for its flowers and its fruits and whatnot. And do not speak while relieving yourself, unless out of necessity, of course, but that's not the time to speak. Just, you know, you do your business and you move on. Number 13, assure the complete excretion of urine. Yani, to make sure that you're done before you get up and move, it would be a better way of stating it. Number 14, one should say when entering, in the name of Allah, I seek refuge from you, from male and female demons. Bismillah, Allahumma inni a'udhu bika min al-khubthi wal-khaba'ith. This is the sunnah dua that the Prophet ﷺ used to say in entering the bathroom. And one should say when exiting, meaning leaving the bathroom, oh Allah, I seek your forgiveness. I thank Allah who has relieved me. Aghufranaka Allahumma. Aghufranaka alhamdulillah alladhi athabani al-adha wa wafani. Sorry, the transliteration wasn't very clear. Now, when it comes to dua, by the way, I just want to also reiterate this, that the greatest resource that you can get yourself is Imam al-Nawawi's Kitab al-Adhkar, the Book of Remembrances, which has been translated by Turath Press. It's something that, you know, every house should have. It's a little expensive. I mean, when I bought it, it was, I think, like 60 sterling pounds or something like that. So it was, I mean, it's costly, but it's a book that's full of barakah, because it's one volume and it's essentially an encyclopedia of all dua that the Prophet ﷺ says for all of these occasions. And that particular translation has the original Arabic, has a transliteration that's very good in English, and the English translation. So you can learn to pronounce the dua and recite them in the original language, as well as knowing what they mean. Okay, what makes a ritual shower mandatory? Al-ghusl. So previously we said that anything that exits the private areas necessitates wudu, but there are some things that come out of the private areas that also necessitate what is greater than the wudu, which is the ghusl. And there are other acts, as we will see. So the first one is the insertion of the penis into the vagina, which is the technical definition in Islamic law of intercourse. So intercourse as iltiqa al-khatinain, the touching, even the touching before the insertion of the two circumcised parts. Now, of course, in the modern age, we have a lot of tafsir, a lot of details about female circumcision, because almost no one knows how to do it, so it becomes harmful. So all of the major fiqh bodies, including the National Fatwa Office of Egypt, which I work with, Dar al-Ifta al-Masriya, and where I did my fatwa training, we do not condone female circumcision. But that's its definition in the Sharia. So even before the insertion, once the penis touches the vagina, that would necessitate a ghusl. Number two is ejaculation of the sexual fluid for both the man and the woman. Number three is the menstruation, the monthly cycle for the woman. Number four is postpartum bleeding and nifas for the woman. So after the woman gives birth, typically there's a period of postnatal bleeding. And number five, the act of giving birth itself. So let's say a woman gave birth, but for some reason had no postnatal bleeding, the fact that she gave birth would require ghusl. There are two obligatory steps for ritual bathing. So what are the obligations for the ghusl? Number one is the intention to remove the state of major ritual impurity. And number three is washing all the hair and skin on the body, even hard to reach places and foreskin. So basically taking a shower and making sure your entire body is wet. What are the recommended actions for ghusl, the sunnahs? Using the siwak beforehand, starting with bismillah, performing the pre-prayer, performing the wudu before starting the shower, that's a sunnah. Washing hard to reach places, like the belly button, skin folds, etc., meaning making an effort to physically wash them rather than just have the water flow on you. Washing the hair and scalp thoroughly with the fingertips, rubbing the whole body, which is means going like this, rather than just standing under the water, and doing every action three times. Purification from major and minor impurities. The following must be met for purification to be accepted. One must be a Muslim, be at an age where one is capable of understanding and surrounding, using pure water, water that is pure in itself and can purify others when used. Okay, so obviously wudu is only for Muslims, we get that. And the wudu, for the wudu to have an effective wudu, the person has to be of mature age, so they're past the age of puberty. We kind of get that. But the most important thing is this idea of pure water. Pure water is a technical term in the Sharia that means water that itself is pure and has the power to purify, which is a Sharia definition. This is, we're not talking about a natural property of water. So he says pure water is free water, al-ma' al-mutlaq, and it is the only type of water that can remove the state of impurity and remove filth. It is water that has fallen from the sky or come from beneath the earth and remained at its original form. So if I have, like I have my flask of water here, if I have this flask of water and I poured in it some lemon juice and some rose water, it's still pure. I can still drink it, but I can't use that to purify me for wudu because the water has changed. It's moved beyond its natural state. Or if I made wudu in a basin and somebody was pouring water for me and I made wudu, all the water that falls from my body in the basin, that's what we call used water, al-ma' al-mustaman. I can't take that water, even though it's pure. You could, I mean, use it to cook. You could give the water to the vegetable grove or something like that. It's pure water, but it's not purifying. It can't lift the wudu for the hadith of somebody else because it is no longer in its original natural state. It has been used. That's what he's going to be talking about in the next couple of sentences. There are two ways that can change the state of water. The first is changes by dissolution. It cannot easily be removed from water. Such as water is mixed with tea, food, cement, spices. This type of water cannot be used for purification. So like as we've added something to it, so the water has changed. Or there could be a natural change. Seawater, water that has mud, plants, rocks, this type of water can be used for purification. So this is a little confusing the way he stated it, because previously he said al-ma' al-mutlaq is any water that has fallen from the sky, beneath the earth, etc. Well, that also includes seawater. So when he writes it as it's changed water, it kind of it can be confusing. But if there's natural salt water, like in the oceans, we are able to use that, the sea, we are able to use that for wudu. But if I took this water and I put salt in it, then I would not be able to make wudu from it. And number two, changes by a solid item that has dropped in the water. It can be easily removed from the water, like an apple, a leaf, a clean toy, a clean utensil, etc. This type of water can be used for purification once the solid item is removed. I mean, you know, if something falls in it, you just take it out. If one uses the water from a bucket or a container for obligatory washing, the remaining water in the container cannot be used for purification nor obligatory washing again. That's what I meant by used water. If once you use the water and it comes on your body and it falls down, that water cannot be used for wudu because it's been considered water that has been used. What makes water impure? Water becomes impure if a filthy item falls into a small amount of water. A small amount of water is a technical Sharia term that comes from the hadith. It's called al-qullatayn, which is one of the hadith, one of the sunnah measurements of volume, which is the equivalent of 216 liters. Whether the water's smell, taste, or color has obviously changed or not. So let's say I have 50 liters of water and a child peed in it, but he just peed a drop. Because it is less than the 216 liters of water, automatically that introduction of impurity makes the water impure. But if the water was 216 liters or more, and the child peed in it, the water is so great, the volume of water is so great that it purifies itself, and therefore we would say it is still pure and purifying. Filthy water can be made pure by doing the following. You can increase the amount by adding more clean water. So in that basin of 50 liters that the child peed in, if I added more water, so we're like 300 liters, then khalas, the water purifies itself. Or you can allow the water to naturally dissolve the filth. Using chemicals to remove or dissolve filth doesn't make the water usable for purification in Islam. Meaning naturally it dissolves itself, not that a foreign agent is included into it. Filth, or I like to translate it as ritual impurity, because some of these things are only understood through the Sharia and not through rational means. Filth in Islam are urine, stool, animal feces, pus, blood, vomit, alcohol. So alcohol is considered najis. Actually, according to the majority opinion, but there are dissents. Vomit, as I said that, vomit, alcohol, all intoxicants, dogs, pigs, or whatever is born by one of the two animal. So any derivative of a dog or a pig, if a dog mated with another animal or a pig mated with another animal, that animal, whatever it's called, would also be considered najis. An animal killed in a non-halal way, like roadkill, it's not the biha, it's killed, that animal is considered najis, including their hair, feathers, skin, and all of its remains. Pre-ejaculation fluid, so there are other fluids that can come out of the body that are not semen. Those would be considered najasa, must be removed. Of course, semen, even though it coming out necessitates the ghusl, is obviously not considered najis, because then we would be najis, because that's where we come from as humans. Semen of a dog or a pig, milk from an animal that is not halal to eat. A whole or part of the human corpus, fish and locusts are considered clean. So the human body is not considered najis. And the fish and locust, anything from the sea is considered tahir, even if it comes out dead. And locust are considered clean. A piece that is cut off from a living being other than those three mentioned is considered filthy, except for hair, feather, skin, or wool from an animal that is halal to eat. Meaning that in the Sharia, there's a general ruling that a part of an animal that comes off of the animal, even if the animal is alive, takes the ruling if that animal was found killed, meaning it's najis, except for the fish, the locust, the human, or the hair, the fur, the skin of an animal that is halal to eat, like a deer or a horse or a cow or a goat or something like that. What can and cannot be purified and how? Vinegar that is naturally produced by alcohol or wine produced from dates and raisin is halal to use, because vinegar was alcohol, and if you leave the alcohol long enough, the alcohol is removed and it becomes vinegar. At-takhallul. So that's how you get vinegar. So how do you make the alcohol permissible to use and consume? Is you just let it stay and until it becomes vinegar without introducing any foreign agent to it. The skin of a halal animal that died unlawfully can be purified by tanning, at-dibagha. So tanning is an elaborate process that makes leather, makes the skin usable by us. How do you know if the leather has been tanned? If it wasn't tanned, it would smell horrendous. It would smell like blood and guts. So any leather that you've ever touched or used in your entire life has been tanned and treated, because then you can use it. If an item becomes filthy by urine, saliva, feces, sweat, or any bodily excretions, it should be of a dog or a pig, or what bores from them or from one of them, then the item must be washed seven times, one of them seven washed with the clean dirt. So the entirety of the dog in the Shafi'i madhab and the entirety of the pig in the Shafi'i madhab is najis. If the liquid part of the animal, its saliva, urine, feces, sweat, touches something, because the liquid, a liquid thing that is impure transmits the impurity. But if the dog like came and just brushed up, like the dog's tail was wagging, the dog's tail hit me and moved, if the dog's tail is dry and my shirt is dry, that najasa does not transmit. What allows the najasa to move from object to object is that it's in a wet host. So if the wetness of the dog or the pig comes up and touches something, licks something, etc., licking because that's where the saliva is, then that item must be washed 7 times, 1 time with dirt. If dirt gets filthy by a dog, the dirt must be washed with pure water 7 times. If a baby boy that hasn't eaten solid foods urinates on an item, sprinkle water over the urine to purify them. But if a young girl, regardless of the solid food or not, because, and this comes from the hadith, there's no rational reason why, that an infant girl, the urine of an infant girl is considered najis from the beginning. But for the boy, it is not najis until they consume solid food. All other filth must be washed until its smell, taste, and color have been removed. However, if color or smell cannot be removed due to its complexity, then it is all right for the item to be used, such as stains. All liquids cannot be purified after it has become filthy, except water, as mentioned before. Okay, tayammum, the dry ablution. Dry tayammum, dry ablution, or pre-prayer washing, is required from both major and minor impurities when one doesn't have access to water, either due to traveling, because usually when people travel, their access to water is naturally limited, or they're sick, there's an illness, they can't use the water because they're sick. For example, surgery that limits you from using water on the skin, or water is cut off in your residence, there's a power outage and there's no water, or at the mosque. Skin covered by bandages should be washed by tayammum, because you're not going to remove the skin and wash it, because then you'll get more harm. Water, however, must be used on areas without bandages. Use water to wipe over solid body casts. Okay, what are the obligations for the tayammum? Transporting the dirt by placing the palm of the hands on the dirt and then the skin. So you tap the earth with your hands such that some of that earth physically comes into your hands. Intention of making the tayammum washing for prayer. Intentions to start when the hand touches the dirt and should remain during the tayammum process until the dirt reaches the face. Number 3 is wiping the face. So you tap once and then you wipe the face. And then you tap a second time and then you do your arm, right, left, just as if it was actually water. And then 4 is wiping the hands to the elbows, which must include the elbows. And number 5 is keeping the order, as mentioned. That's it. Once you do that, then you can pray, obviously given the conditions that you have a legitimate condition not to make wudu with water. Okay, what are the conditions for doing this? Number 1 is you use clean, dry dirt that has dust when beaten. Hit the dirt once to wipe the face and once to wipe the hands to the elbows. Number 2, tayammum should only be performed after the time of prayer has begun. So if there's no water right now, and we were informed that there'll be no water for the whole day, I can't make tayammum now for all of the prayers, because tayammum does not have the power that actual wudu has. Tayammum simply allows us to pray on time, but it does not lift the hadath. So it is of like a weaker force, you can say. So for that reason, I can only do it once the adhan of that prayer has come in. Number 3, tayammum should be performed for each obligatory prayer as long as water is still not available. So it's not going to last like all through Dhuhr and Asr, as I just said. Number 4, one should search for water prior to tayammum and should ask everyone that surrounds him or her if possible. So in other words, you have to make an effort to seek out water. That's reasonable effort. Number five, if neither water or dirt are accessible, then one should pray alone without washing and then make up the prayer when one of the two becomes available. And number six, tayammum can be performed if water is extremely cold and warming it is not possible, because then therefore using the water would be harmful. If tayammum is done due to extreme cold water or sinful traveling, then the person's prayer must be made up. Okay, this needs to be explained. If there's water that's cold, it's just too cold to use, and it's just too cold and the heating is not working, or we're outside and hiking, I can't roll up my, it's just too cold. Okay, you make tayammum and you pray, there's no sin. But you have to make up that prayer because you did not reach the full reasons for the full exemption of water because you actually had water. That's understandable. What does sinful traveling mean? Sinful traveling means that the purpose of the traveling is sinful, not that you're traveling and you committed a sin while you're traveling. So I'm going to go travel to Las Vegas because I want to go on a gambling trip with my friends. That's my intention. So the whole safar, the whole travel is sinful. We call this al-ma'siyah bil safar, that the sin is in the travel itself. Let's say I'm flying to California to attend an Islamic conference and there's a transit in Las Vegas and I get out on the terminal and I start gambling in the slot machines in the airport. You know, may Allah Ta'ala protect us. That's a sin, but I can still make tayammum if I didn't have water, etc. Because this is al-ma'siyah fil safar. This is a sin while traveling, but the traveling itself wasn't sinful. I just make that example so people understand. Okay. We'll just do this menstruation part and then we'll conclude here because there's a lot of fiqh and I don't want the clips to be too long such that people will never look or benefit from them. Menstruation and postnatal bleeding. The shortest duration of menstruation is 1 day and one night. So if a woman starts showing blood, the minimum, the Sharia defines the minimum high the period is 24 hours. So at a minimum, you have to wait 24 hours. And then after that, if there's nothing else, you can wash and pray. The longest, however, is 15 days, which means if I have some bleeding today, and then tomorrow and the day after I have no bleeding, and then the third day I'm showing blood again, I'm still within the 15 days. So that means that this is linked to that. However, the average is 6 or 7. The following is forbidden during the menstruation. It is, or let's say the things that a woman can't do when she's menstruating. She can't pray, obviously. She can't do tawaf. She can't touch or carry the Quran. She can't stay in the masjid. And she can't read the Quran. What does read the Quran mean? Read the Quran is defined as out loud, saying Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, Ar-Rahmanir Rahim, like that. But if a woman had like a app and she went over the verses silently, that wouldn't be considered reading. So there are ways around this for sisters to maintain their like wird of Quran if they're memorizing and review. Okay, forbidden acts during the menstruation is fasting. So a woman can't fast. She can't walk through the masjid if blood may possibly leak, meaning passing through like door to door or something like that. For men and women, intimate reactions. There's no fondling with what is between the navel and the knee. And intercourse during menstruation is one of the major sins. So for a man and woman, they can enjoy each other intimately during the woman's menstrual cycle, but the woman's private area needs to be covered. A woman needs to make up her fasting from the days of Ramadan, but not the missed prayers. So if a woman misses fasting due to her menstrual cycle, she obviously makes those days up. But the prayers that a sister misses, she doesn't have to make up. If menstruation stops, she can start fasting even before performing the ritual shower, because being in a state of wudu or tahara is not a condition for the fast to start. And postnatal bleeding is equivalent to the laws of menstruation that we just talked about. Wallahu ta'ala a'la wa a'lam wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa sallam. Are there any questions? The book I mentioned about the dua is the Kitab al-Adhkar of Imam al-Nawawi. I think I have a copy. Let me just grab it so I can show it to everybody. The Book of Remembrance, and this is published by Turath Publishing. Turath Publishing. So this book, this actual edition, is really awesome because, as I said, like, you will find the original Arabic, and then below the Arabic, you will find a full transliteration. And then underneath that, you will find the translation. So any dua, like, let's say, what are the duas that I should say before I sleep? What are the duas to say to protect my children? What are the duas to say if I go to the mosque, when I leave the mosque, I enter the bathroom? What are the duas that the Prophet used to say in the actual prayer? All of those you're going to find in this one book. And that this is the ultimate, one of the best books ever written. Because it's so short and it just has all of the dua, and you just follow them. So I highly, 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 highly recommend that people invest and get this book. Okay. We will resume our teaching of this book on Sunday, inshallah, at the same time. Everyone be well, be safe, have a good weekend, and I'll see you on Sunday. Wa akhiru da'wana alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. وصلى اللهم على سيدنا ومولانا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.